Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. A CDC advisory committee votes to recommend the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine booster shots for the elderly and some people at risk for severe disease, but not for those in jobs or institutions with high transmission, such as teachers, prisoners, healthcare workers. House and Senate Democratic leaders announcing a tax framework agreement with the White House to pay for their $3.5 trillion social spending bill, but not releasing many details. The House approves $1 billion for Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. It was a standalone bill after the money was taken out of an earlier bill involving temporary government funding and a debt limit increase, this after opposition from progressive Democrats. U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigning in protest over the mass deportation of Haitian migrants from the U.S.-Mexico border, calling it inhumane, will get White House reaction. And U.S. House hearing on unruly airline passengers, several members of Congress linking the phenomenon to the wider political debate. From the Associated Press, the U.S. vaccination drive against COVID-19 stood on the verge of a major new phase as government advisors Thursday recommended booster doses of Pfizer's vaccine for millions of older or otherwise vulnerable Americans. Despite doubts, the extra shots will do much to slow the pandemic. Advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying boosters should be offered to people 65 and older, nursing home residents, and those ages 50 to 64 who have risky underlying health problems. The extra dose would be given once they're at least 6 months past their last Pfizer shot. But deciding who else might get one was far tougher. While there was little evidence that younger people are at risk of waning immunity, the panel offered the option of a booster for those 18 to 49 who have chronic health problems and want one. That from AP. Ahead of the day-long virtual meeting, some opening remarks from the CDC Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Like you, I'm approaching this decision with an interest in doing what's right for the public health. And like you, I can't close my eyes to my experience as a clinician. Collectively, we want to do what's right for the millions of Americans over the age of 65 and in long-term care facilities who are at high risk of severe complications of COVID-19. And like you, I'm also thinking about the 25-year-old man with cystic fibrosis who may walk into our clinic, nervous about his risk for one more hospitalization. And also of the 35-year-old pregnant resident physician working in a Tennessee emergency room with a one-year-old at home. It's in these complicated decisions where ACIP has always led, valuing safety, equity, and access for those at risk. And it's here where I am most grateful for your guidance. I appreciate your meticulous review of the data available from CDC's own cohort studies, from FDA's review of Pfizer's studies, and from public health partners and institutions around the world. These data are not perfect, yet collectively they form a picture for us, and they are what we have in this moment to make a decision about the next stage in this pandemic. Thank you for leaning into this complexity, trying to fit the pieces together and to come to the best conclusion.
The CDC Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, at the start of today's virtual meeting of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices on providing that additional dose of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to certain groups of people. And with Dr. Walensky's sign-off, the booster shots can be given out immediately to the groups that have been approved. Now, there was one vote that failed, and that was to provide a booster shot for teachers and other first responders, healthcare workers, and people in institutions like prisoners where the risk of transmission is high. The vote in the advisory committee was 6 yeses and 9 noes, and that goes counter what the Food and Drug Administration recommended late Wednesday. Now to spending bills pending before Congress, again from AP. The White House and congressional Democrats have agreed to a framework to pay for their huge emerging social and environmental bill, top Democrats said Thursday, but they offered no details and the significance was unclear. Democratic leaders and President Joe Biden have wanted the measure to total $3.5 trillion over 10 years. Senator Chuck Schumer, majority leader in the Senate, joining Speaker Pelosi at her weekly briefing.
The White House, the House, and the Senate have reached agreement on a framework that will pay for any final negotiated agreement. So the revenue side of this we have an agreement on. Okay?
Thank you.
An agreement of a framework. Okay? Thanks.
After that brief statement, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer left the news conference. Reporters asking Speaker Nancy Pelosi what this framework agreement means.
Can you please elaborate on what Senator Schumer just said? He said that you have reached an agreement on a framework that will pay for any final negotiated settlement. Does that mean House Democrats and progressives and moderates have agreed on tax rates, how much this bill will cost, and a price tag?
What we said was the House, the Senate, and the White House came to an agreement on how we can go forward in a way to pay for this. I don't know how you define some of the terms you use loosely there, but overwhelmingly, our New Dem coalition, which a long segment of our moderates and represented us at the meeting yesterday, have been very strong on child tax credit, extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies and the rest. The list goes on. Though we have consensus in overwhelmingly, maybe 10 to 1, 20 to 1 in our caucus as to these priorities, a higher percentage in the Senate. But we wanted to make sure that it was paid for. And I'm a pay-go person. Pay as you go. Sometimes I have a little disagreement in my caucus with some who just don't necessarily think we should do that, but I do. And we came to terms as to a framework of an array of agreements that we have, depending on what the need is. Now, at the same time, we're finalizing on the outlay side. So if we need more, we need less, that will impact the choices we make there. But this was great progress. Not in terms of, it's just that it's writing bills, and it takes time, and you have to make decisions. And that's what we did.
No,
we didn't talk about that. This is not about price tag. This is about what's in the bill. What's in the bill? For children, what's in the bill? Universal pre-K, child care, child tax credit, family medical leave for their families, protecting the planet for them. It's about specific legislation. How much does that cost? How do we pay for it? It's about the climate issues, as I ended on that, on the climate issues in terms of using the tax code to stimulate the business aspects of this to meet the emissions goals. And that's part of how we make some decisions in there. Does this use of the tax cut help meet the president's emission goals that we have as a nation? So it's not about a price tag or anything. It's about values, not dollars. And when we come to agreement on what people are for, or what they would cut if they want to do less. What would you cut? But our goal is to have a very specific priorities clearly presented with as close as possible results as possible. And I'm very, very proud of the work of our members on that score.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at a news conference. More from the Associated Press story on the budget reconciliation bill and this framework. They write, the Democratic Party has been divided over the final size and many of the details, and there has been no public word that agreements have been reached on any of those crucial questions. Statements by Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi left unclear whether the administration and congressional bargainers had made decisions actually paring down their options for financing the bill or simply working off a broad menu of options that already existed. Also unclear was whether the framework was a step forward, resolving the myriad disputes between rank-and-file party moderates and progressives that have slowed work on the legislation, and there was no initial public indication that it had. Over at the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about this pay-for framework.
Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi came out and said they have agreement with the White House on a menu of options to pay for the agenda. Senator Manchin, Senator Sanders have indicated they don't know what's on that menu. Can you give us some details about what is on that menu and maybe like a rough range, maybe specific options, anything that shows that this is progress?
Well, first, Josh, we certainly think it's progress, and it builds on the president's meetings he had yesterday with leadership, with moderates, with progressives, to talk about the path forward in an effort to unify members of the Democratic Party and caucus around our shared objective of lowering costs for Americans and making the tax code more fair. As Leader Schumer saw, I know you followed it closely, but for others, as Leader Schumer said, I should say, he conveyed what has been agreed to is a menu of options that will pay for whatever the agreement on the investment may look like. And so it's a menu of revenue raisers. Now, I think, as you may understand, it's important to have those discussions with the range of important leaders, including Senator Sinema, Senator Manchin, a range of members, about what those menu of options of revenue raisers look like. That's exactly the process that's going to happen over the short term. So I'm going to let that play out before I detail more from here. I would otherwise point you to Leader Schumer's office.
Okay. Secondly, I know you don't want to negotiate from the podium.
I typically try not to.
Exactly. But are there any items where there is unity among Democratic lawmakers in the White House, like with regard to the child tax credit, universal pre-K? Is there anything where you can say, we have agreement that we want these programs at this level?
Well, I think what's important to note here, and you gave me an opportunity to do this, is there is broad unity about the importance of, again, lowering costs for Americans, whether it's child care, elder care, the cost of college, cost of pre-K. That's all part of the discussion. Child tax credit. There's broad agreement that we need to do more to address the climate crisis. There's extensive proposals both in the infrastructure package as well as in the reconciliation package. A big part of what we're talking about here, which is not a secret to all of you, are the size of the package, right? There are a range of different viewpoints on that. That's part of what the discussion is, and that will certainly impact as we look toward how we're going to unify moving forward.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. TheHill.com writes that the announcement about the framework appeared to catch some senators by surprise, as key players said Thursday morning that they didn't know what was in the framework. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, senior member of the Finance Committee, said he didn't have the foggiest idea of what it included. Senate Budget Committee Chair Bernie Sanders said that he'd seen the framework, but there was not a whole lot new from what the House and Senate panels had disclosed as possible pay-fors. There's this from CNN's Kevin Liptak tweeting that an aide to Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, a key moderate, we have seen nothing and have not signed off on anything. Well, Senator Bernie Sanders spoke on the Senate floor this afternoon, and he did so to emphasize that whatever this is in this framework agreement, the total spending in the budget reconciliation bill must be at least $3.5 trillion.
There has been a lot of talk lately about the need to compromise. Well, let me be clear. To a very significant degree, that has already taken place. Of the 11 Democratic members of the Senate Budget Committee, 9 understood the need for a $6 trillion bill, which would finally address the unmet needs, the long-ignored needs of the working families of our country, as well as begin the process of tackling the existential threat of climate change. My guess is that at least 40 out of the 50 members of the Democratic caucus supported the $6 trillion proposal. We compromised big time. We cut that proposal, or agreed to cut that proposal, almost in half, down to $3.5 trillion. That, Mr. President, to my mind, is a major, major compromise. And as we go forward in this debate, let me be as clear as I can be as to why every penny of that $3.5 trillion is absolutely needed. And let me also make clear that this bill, despite some of the rhetoric coming from my Republican colleagues, will not add, should not add, and will not add one nickel to the deficit. It will be paid for. It will be paid for by finally demanding that some of the wealthiest people in this country, who in any given year, we're talking about multi-billionaires, who in a given year do not pay a nickel in federal income tax, or dozens of large profitable corporations that in a given year do not pay a nickel in federal income tax. Well, we are going to demand that these people start paying their fair share of taxes. And that is more than enough money to cover the $3.5 trillion that is in this proposal.
Senator Bernie Sanders, independent, who caucuses with the Democrats, chair of the Budget Committee on the Senate floor. As negotiations over the larger budget bill continue, the $3.5 trillion, a separate $1 trillion package of road and infrastructure projects that already passed the Senate is scheduled for a House vote on Monday. It's a key demand of some House moderate Democrats, even though House progressive Democrats are threatening to vote against it because they want the larger bill passed first. The $1 trillion bill did get some Senate Republican support, and today House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy was asked about it.
Are you encouraging your members or whipping your members against the bipartisan infrastructure bill on Monday?
You know, I don't view it as a bipartisan bill any longer, where the Democrats have now made it one over $5 trillion bill, one without the other. It only harmed the nation even more. I'm voting no.
What about your members? Do you encourage them to vote no, too?
Yes, I do. Yes, ma'am.
Can I follow up on that question, Sure. Mayor McCarthy? A lot of the things in this bipartisan infrastructure bill are things that your members have backed in the past and are popular at home. What's your message to constituents, even in your district, who could get millions of dollars of money for roads or broadband, about why you're voting no?
Because you don't get millions of dollars for roads and broadband. What you get is $5 trillion of more inflation. You get a bigger socialist big government. You get a harm to our economy. And from the whole perspective of the roads being built, we had a bill that went forward that had the opportunity to build more roads, less money, have the reforms to get it done, and you didn't have to have the Green New Deal.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy at his weekly news conference on Capitol Hill. From CBS News, the House on Thursday approved a bill providing $1 billion for Israel's Iron Dome defense system, 2 days after the funding was stripped from a short-term government funding bill amid objections from progressive lawmakers. The measure cleared the House in a bipartisan vote of 420-9. 8 Democrats and 1 Republican voted against the funding. 2 other Democrats voted present, Hank Johnson of Georgia, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat and chair of the Appropriations Committee, presented the bill on the House floor.
In May, during the latest period of increased violence between Israel and Hamas, more than 4,000 rockets were launched from Gaza. Using radar technology and missiles to track and destroy incoming rockets, the Iron Dome intercepted over 90% of the rockets that would have landed in civilian populated areas. This system, with help from Congress's funding, saved thousands of lives in that month alone. Under the 2016 Memorandum of Understanding between the United States and Israel, the United States is committed to replenishing the Iron Dome so Israel can continue to defend itself from attack and protect its citizens. With the funding in this bill, the Iron Dome would continue to protect millions of civilians. Let me repeat, this funding, as the bill language clearly states, is limited to a system that is entirely defensive. And there was no greater demonstration of the defensive nature of this system than the videos showing the Iron Dome's interception capacity. Now, Mr. Speaker, the United States has long been committed to the objective of a two-state solution, Israelis and Palestinians living side by side in a lasting peace. The legislation before us ensures that Israel can fully defend all its citizens, a necessary condition for lasting peace. And our state foreign operations and related programs funding bill, passed by the House over the summer, we provided funding to help meet the humanitarian and development needs of the Palestinian people, another requirement for lasting peace.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, chair of the Appropriations Committee, Democrat from Connecticut. One of the 9 no votes on this bill today was Democrat Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. You will hear her, followed by Republican Chuck Fleischmann of Tennessee.
I rise in opposition to this supplemental. I will not support an effort to enable and support war crimes, human rights abuses, and violence. We cannot be talking only about Israelis' need for safety at a time when Palestinians are living under a violent apartheid system and are dying from what Human Rights Watch has said are war crimes. We should also be talking about Palestinian need for security from Israeli attacks. We must be consistent in our commitment to human life, period. Everyone deserves to be safe there. The bill claims to be, quote, a replenishment for weapons apartheid Israel used in a crisis it manufactured when it attacked worshipers at one of the most holiest Islamic locations, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, committing, again, numerous war crimes. And yet, a $1 billion in American tax dollars that my colleagues want to give represents, to me, an absurd and unjustifiable 140 times increase to U.S. funding for the Iron Dome. I firmly believe our country must oppose selling weapons to anyone, anywhere, without human rights law compliance. The Israeli government is an apartheid regime. Not my words, the words of Human Rights Watch and Israel's own Human Rights Watch organization, B'Tselem. I urge my colleagues, please stand with me in supporting human rights for all. I yield.
Mr. Speaker, I yield myself as much time as necessary to respond to this
comment. Is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, the truth has finally come out on the floor of the House of the United States of America. I heard some of my Democratic colleagues stand with me, with Israel, with our ally, to fight terrorism with a defensive weapon system. And what did we just hear? We heard the Democratic Party speak out. We heard right now from my colleague across the aisle with a shocking statement. She opposes this because they have a vocal minority in the majority party that is anti-Israel, that is anti-Semitic, and as Americans, we can never stand for that. I grew up with Holocaust survivors. I grew up with children of Holocaust survivors. Israel has been attacked and attacked and attacked since its inception. As Americans, I beseech you, I reach out to the majority and I say, condemn what we just heard on the floor. Condemn terrorism. This is a defensive weapon system.
Chuck Fleischman and Rashida Tlaib debate on the House floor before this bill passed overwhelmingly. It is now heading over to the Senate. And as mentioned earlier, this $1 billion for Israel was removed from another bill that would keep the federal government funded from October 1st, the new fiscal year, through December 3rd, and also extend the national debt limit until December 2022. That bill also pending in the Senate. From Bloomberg News, the head of the U.S. Cybersecurity Enforcement Agency is supporting bipartisan legislation to mandate that operators of critical infrastructure report data breaches to the government. Jen Easterly, director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, said she backs draft legislation from the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee to require certain private companies, federal agencies, and government contractors to report cyber attacks to the agency. Here's part of the hearing. The chair is Senator Gary Peters.
All of you are well aware that Ranking Member Portman and I are working together on an incident reporting bill that would require specific companies to report to CISA regarding cyber intrusions and when they make ransomware payments as well. Certainly, after thousands of cyber attacks, including SolarWinds, the Microsoft Exchange, and the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, I think it's probably well past time for us to have some sensible legislation put forward to make sure that we're getting timely information about these incidents. My first question is for Director Easterly. If our incident reporting bill were enacted, what would CISA do with this information, and how would you be able to help victims?
Thanks very much for your question, Chairman. First of all, we really appreciate this effort. We absolutely agree it's long past time to get cyber incident reporting legislation out there, and we're excited to work with you on this. CISA plays a critical role as the National Coordinator for Critical Infrastructure Resilience and Security. As I think about CISA's superpower that we use on behalf of the nation and the American people is our ability to share information rapidly to enable us to protect other potential victims. So what we could do with this information is not only render assistance to the victim and help them remediate and recover from the attack, but we could use that information, we could analyze it, and then we could share it broadly to see whether, in fact, evidence of such intrusions were found across the sector or, frankly, across other sectors or across the federal civilian executive branch. So we think that timely and relevant reporting of cyber incidents is absolutely critical to help us raise the baseline and protect the cyber ecosystem.
Jen Easterly, director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Also testifying, the White House National Cyber Director, Chris Inglis. And you can find the full hearing at cspan.org. Another line from the Bloomberg News article on this hearing: an increase in cyber attacks, particularly from ransomware, has hit the private sector particularly hard, which owns and operates 85% of critical infrastructure. On Wall Street, the Dow regaining the losses from early in the week, up today 506, NASDAQ up 155, S&P up 53. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. The Biden administration's special envoy to Haiti has resigned in protest over the expulsion of Haitian migrants from the Texas border town of Del Rio. Daniel Foote is a career diplomat. He was appointed as envoy in July. A question today to the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki.
And then on Haiti, we saw the U.S. special envoy, Daniel Foote, resigning. He had strong words. He said he would not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees. Why would DHS go ahead with a plan against the special envoy's advice?
Well, let's take a step back here for a moment. I would also first note that the State Department put out a statement on his resignation. He was obviously an employee of the State Department and, of course, of the administration. First, I would note there have been multiple senior-level policy conversations on Haiti where all proposals, including those led by Special Envoy Foote, were fully considered in a rigorous policy process. There are disagreements in these policy processes. That the president welcomes that, the secretary of state welcomes that. That's certainly a part of having discussions and having robust discussions about the best path forward for difficult circumstances. Some of those proposals were harmful to our commitment to the promotion of democracy in Haiti. I'm not going to detail that further. I will let the State Department do that should they choose to. But I would note Special Envoy Foote had ample opportunity to raise concerns about migration during his tenure. He never once did so. Now, that wasn't his purview. His purview was, of course, being the special envoy on the ground. His positions were and his views were put forward. They were valued. They were heard. Different policy decisions were made in some circumstances.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. State Department spokesman Ned Price putting out a statement as well. Reading, this is a challenging moment that requires leadership. It is unfortunate that instead of participating in a solutions-oriented policy process, Special Envoy Foote has both resigned and mischaracterized the circumstances of his resignation. No ideas are ignored, but not all ideas are good ideas. Part of the statement from the State Department spokesman Ned Price. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki also announcing today that horseback patrols in Del Rio, Texas, will be suspended. This after the images and video circulated showing Border Patrol agents using horse reins to round up the Haitian migrants.
So what he has asked all of us to convey clearly to people who are understandably have questions, are passionate, are concerned, as we are about the images that we have seen, is one, we feel those images are horrible and horrific. There is an investigation the president certainly supports, overseen by the Department of Homeland Security, which he has conveyed will happen quickly. I can also convey to you that the secretary also conveyed to civil rights leaders earlier this morning that we would no longer be using horses in Del Rio. So that is something, a policy change that has been made in response.
Jen Psaki at the White House. The Homeland Security Department says about 7,000 migrants remain in Del Rio. That's down from a peak of about 15,000 last weekend. Department says about 1,400 have been flown back to Haiti. Around 3,200 have been moved to other sectors to speed up processing, and several thousand have gone back across the border into Mexico. The Federal Aviation Administration saying the rate of violent or disruptive airline passenger incidents has fallen 50% since regulators imposed the zero-tolerance policy with fines earlier this year. But the rate is still twice as high as last year. As of this week, there were 4,385 reported unruly passenger incidents. According to the FAA, three-quarters of those related to face mask requirements. On Capitol Hill, the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee holding a hearing about this. Both Republican and Democratic members of the committee linking what's happening on planes to the wider political context. First, Democrat Hank Johnson.
Rage has become the defining emotion of our times, and we witnessed rage from Trump and members of Congress when Trump lost the election. The flying public was pummeled with false claims that the election was stolen, and we all witnessed the rage against Congress, spurred on by those same leaders who instigated the infamous insurrection on January 6th. These are the same leaders who spread the other big lie that the COVID-19 pandemic is a fraud, you can't believe Dr. Fauci, and that Democrats are taking away your personal freedom with mask mandates. As a result, people are angry and confused. They get on flights and they let out their rage after having seen their leaders refuse to follow the rules. They have seen belligerence from the nation's highest leaders become acceptable behavior. So if the leaders can do it and get away with it, they think it's okay for them to do the same thing. So when they get to the airport, folks feel like they can say and do anything they want because they have been misled into believing that their personal freedom trumps, pun intended, their responsibility to their fellow man or for the common good. Then politicians blame air flight rage on hypocrisy of those who take off their masks to eat at airport restaurants. Unbelievable. Rage is emboldened by the careless and ill-thought-out actions of leaders who insist the pandemic is unreal and who eschew public health safety measures. Rage in disguise is one of the unfortunate but predictable results.
Congressman Hank Johnson, Democrat from Georgia. Also at today's Transportation Committee hearing, Troy Nels, Republican from Texas.
It is unfortunate our airline employees are facing difficult times. It is unfortunate flight attendants are tasked with enforcing mandatory mask mandates on children 2 years old. It is unfortunate flight attendants are required to patrol up and down the aisles, ensuring small children are complying with these mask mandates. And it is unfortunate these same flight attendants are tasked with reporting these children and their families to authorities. It is also unfortunate these families, after explaining to the flight attendant that their child suffers from anxiety or are autistic or suffers from asthma, which places that child in an unnecessary health risk, will be forcibly removed, if necessary, from that flight. I was not refusing a mask, nor did I even say I wouldn't try to keep a mask on my son. We were escorted off the plane as I was holding a mask over his little face. I genuinely don't have words. And quite honestly, I wouldn't know what to say to that mother. It is important to note this administration is flying illegal immigrants around our country on commercial airlines using taxpayer dollars, with many of them not tested for COVID-19. The hypocrisy of this administration may be a contributing factor to increased tension on our airline employees.
Congressman Troy Nels, Republican from Texas, at today's Transportation and Infrastructure Committee hearing. The witnesses included a flight attendant and a representative of the Flight Attendants Union, also representative of the Airports Council and an airline trade group. We covered it on C-SPAN. You can find the video archived at cspan.org, our video library. Can workplace experts help members of Congress from different parties be civil to each other, get along, even collaborate to get things done? Some of the questions at today's hearing by the House Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. Sports analogies came up frequently. Here is Ed Perlmutter, Democrat from Colorado, questioning two of the witnesses, Professor Allison Craig and author Shola Richards.
Going back to the sports analogy, you know, at the Broncos, two of our fiercest competitors were the leaders of the team, Peyton Manning and John Elway. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I mean, they wanted to win, period. And made it a better team. What we have under this, in this room under the dome, is we have two teams competing. It's different than Microsoft and everybody getting in the room and debating, you know, towards the thing. They're part of the same team. So what has been difficult for all of us is the team element has become more and more pronounced over time. So I just open it to the three of you because I think you're all talking, you know, from the leadership, you know, the more competitive the leader, you know, all of a sudden you're going down one path. And I can pick a couple of my committees where I have just a fiercest competitive leader in one committee versus a more collaborative leader in another committee. And you get different results. There's no question about it. So in the setting that we have, which is different than a corporate setting, you know, it's we're sort of in the game the whole time. How do you manage that? How do you bring out civility? How do you bring out the collaboration? I guess that's my question.
Sure. So I can jump in on this. You know, I think I do think there's a perception issue more so than, I mean, yes, there are absolutely competing teams. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to come in here and be like, no, everyone really gets along. But the we actually do have a fair amount of research showing that the majority of members are mostly just focused on, you know, creating policy solutions and or district advocacy. Like a majority are a bare majority, but a majority are focused on that end. And so that's where I see the role of collaboration, I think, being really impactful is actually getting those like rank and file members who are less concerned about the partisan fighting that's going on over here and more concerned about working together and making these connections. And because, like I said, you know, kind of collaboration facilitates more collaboration. So if you have these two members that are really concerned about policy working together and then, oh, they're successful, like other people will hopefully try to imitate that behavior and expand the, you know, value, the norm of collaboration within Congress by just demonstrating good behavior or collaborative behavior anyway.
Can I jump in too? Thank you for that, Dr. Craig. I just love sports metaphors because, I mean, using Peyton Manning and John Elway is a great example for this. And I know your district is obviously in Colorado. And the idea, right? The idea is when you talk about John Elway and Peyton Manning, the two things about them, besides being Super Bowl winning quarterbacks for the Denver Broncos, they also are not just fierce competitors, but they did something that could also be duplicated within this institution. You mentioned before that there's fierce teams that are separated and they're fighting for their cause. So the one thing that could help interrupt that is intra-party policing, where there is someone within the party who is willing to say, hey, listen, you can fight for your cause and fight hard, but still, let's remain within these guardrails. It's far more powerful hearing it from someone within your own party who's willing to see, hey, this is not okay. Like, I understand that you're fierce, but to get on social media, to run to said news network and just start to disrespect or humiliate someone is not advancing this cause. And this is gonna take courage. Quite frankly, and I know courage is a relative term, but the idea is this is going to require people to put their necks out a little bit. I think if you are in a, politically speaking, a safe district where you are most likely to be reelected over and over and over again, and because for whatever reason there's more people in your party there, whether it's deep blue or deep red, there's less of a willingness to want to engage, for sure, if we're going to be honest. But the idea is If someone from the party, within the party, chooses to hold someone accountable, this is beginning the process of turning the ship around that's been so off track for so long. And that's what Peyton Manning did. That's what John Elway did. They went to the situation, and even Tom Brady, who, sorry, but he went to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers after they were a horrible team and 1 year turned them around. And I think it's because the inside of the team, there's a spirit of accountability, which I think is sometimes absent in this partisan bickering that we see so often.
Shola Richards is an author and workplace expert, testifying along with Allison Craig, an assistant professor, University of Texas at Austin, before the House Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. Today's hearing titled Pathways to Success, How Practicing Civility, Collaboration, and Leadership Can Empower Members. Vice President Kamala Harris making history today, meeting with the visiting Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. That makes Harris the highest ranking Indian American to welcome the leader of India.
And Mr. Prime Minister, I look forward to discussing how our nations can continue to best work together to strengthen our relationship around our mutual concerns, around the challenges we face, but the opportunities that those challenges also present. I know from personal experience and from my family of the commitment of the Indian people to democracy and to freedom and to the work that may be done and can be done to imagine and then actually achieve our vision for democratic principles and institutions. Thank you.
Vice President Kamala Harris in her ceremonial office in Washington with the visiting Prime Minister of India. Harris's mother was born in India. Harris and President Joe Biden will each meet on Friday with leaders of the so-called Quad, U.S., India, Japan, and Australia. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. And for more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. You can find out how at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.